From NPR News and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. It is a historic day in Cuba. Raul Castro's tenure as president is over after he led the country for over a decade. His handpicked successor, Miguel Díaz-Canel, is the new president of the island. This will be the first time in nearly 60 years that Cuba is ruled by someone outside the Castro family. We're joined by NPR international correspondent Carrie Kahn, who is in Havana. Hello, Carrie.
Hi.
So the change is not a surprise, the changing of the guard, but this is a momentous change in a country that's been defined by the Castros. Most Cubans alive today have not known Cuba without a Castro. So how are people reacting to the change today?
Oh, it's difficult when you go talk to Cubans, especially lately. They'll sort of subtly tell you they're not really watching the proceedings that much. They're on live occasionally on state TV. You talk to people and they just are very skeptical. They don't really think anything's going to change.
So I wonder, in fact, what will change under this new president, Miguel Díaz-Canel. As we said, Castro officially stepped down. Miguel Díaz-Canel was handpicked to replace him. He addressed the National Assembly today. What did he say?
He pretty much said all decisions will go through Raul. He said there is no room for negotiation. He said there will not be capitalism in Cuba and there will be continuity with the country's socialistic principles. So he pretty much laid out that all decisions will still go through Raul. Here's a little bit of what he said.
Y al mismo tiempo, para avanzar sin prisa pero sin pausa, salve advertencia del compañero Raul hacia el horizonte, hacia la prosperidad que nos debemos.
What he's saying there is, he's like, we're not walking back from Cuba. Cuba's socialistic future. And he says at the same time, we will advance without speed and also without pause. And that's he's quoting from an often used phrase of Raul Castro's when he initiated economic reforms back in 2011 here. So it's often used, you know, we're going to go forward, but not too fast, and we're not going to slow down.
I wonder if he's saying that in part. I mean, he's a different generation than Raul Castro. This man is 58. I think he turns 58 tomorrow. Can we trust his words that when he says things are going to continue along the lines they are, especially given that the island is in such dire economic straits, is that likely the way it's going to be?
Well, clearly, Raul Castro held three titles here on the island. He was the president, he was the head of the Communist Party, and he's the head of the army. All he did today was give up being the head, the president. And that's the one that has the least power of it. So clearly he's still in charge. So I think we can hold Díaz-Canel to his word, but not much is going to change. Although Raul Castro just spoke at the National Assembly, he spoke for a long time. And one of the things that he said, that he is going to step down from the Communist Party in 2021, in 3 years. And he did say, when I am gone, Díaz-Canel will be the head of the Communist Party. So that was kind of interesting.
When in the beginning here, you mentioned that Cubans aren't really saying much, apparently don't feel entitled or safe saying anything about this change. So you privy to anything that anyone has told you behind the scenes?
Well, I think people are very disappointed with the economic situation here in Cuba. It's dire. If you work for the state, which 2/3 of the people in Cuba do, you make about $30 a month. There's no way people can live off that. So what they do is hopefully they get some sort of help from relatives abroad, or they steal from the state and work in some sort of area that they can to sell goods that they've taken from the states, or some sort of petty corruption. That's the only way to make it here, unless you are lucky to be in the private sector. But the private sector has taken a big blow here. About 600,000 people are now in the private sector. But since President Trump reinstated travel restrictions for Americans, American tourists to the island has dropped precipitously. And I talked to a lot of people. This is the low season of tourism, but people are saying the high season felt like the low season. They could really feel something like 50% drop in tourists to the island.
And by the way, just along those lines, I think a lot of Americans are interested in Cuba and in going there. How hard is it right now to go there directly from the U.S. and to go there legally?
Well, there's lots of flights from the U.S., but you have to go in an organized tour group. You have to satisfy certain categories. So there is travel from the United States, and there is legal travel. It's just not as easy as it was under the Obama administration.
Okay, thank you very much. Speaking to us from Havana, NPR international correspondent Carrie Kahn, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome.
Scientists in California released the results yesterday of an alarming earthquake simulation near Oakland, California. The report by the U.S. Geological Survey predicts that a 7.0 magnitude earthquake along the Hayward Fault would likely kill up to 800 people and cause more than $100 billion in damage. The study says a quake of that size would also ignite up to 400 fires in the Bay Area that could destroy the equivalent of 52,000 homes. Joining us now is David Schwartz. He's an earthquake geologist emeritus at the Geological Survey, and he contributed to this report. David, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So people who live on the West Coast talk about quakes and the possibility of the big one, of course, but this simulation sounds pretty terrifying. Tell us about the Hayward Fault, you know, where it runs, and what makes it so dangerous.
Well, the Hayward Fault is probably one of the most hazardous faults in the country. And the reason is that it passes through the most highly urbanized part of the Bay Area. In the Bay Area, we have 7 million people. 2 million live directly along the fault. The fault's about 52 miles long. And in 1868, the fault produced, we think, a magnitude 6.8, 6.9 earthquake. Of course, there were no seismographs back then. And we've done a lot of study of the fault. And we've been able to work out its history going back about 1900 years. And in those 1900 years, we see evidence of 12 earthquakes comparable to what happened in 1868 or maybe larger. And the last one was 150 years ago. And the average return time or repeat time for these 12 earthquakes is 150 to 160 years. So when we play these kind of average math games, we are right there.
Yeah, the area seems overdue for another major earthquake. And as you point out, 2 million people live on top of the fault. Do you think people underestimate Hayward? Most people know about the San Andreas Fault due to popular culture, but this seems to pose a bigger threat.
Well, I think in reality it does pose a much larger hazard. The ground shaking that the fault will produce when it ruptures will not only be felt in the East Bay and do damage in the East Bay, but will affect San Francisco. And in fact, in 1868, when the fault last moved, it did primary damage in San Francisco because the East Bay was largely uninhabited. And until the 1906 earthquake, the 1868 earthquake was called a big one out here in the Bay Area.
David, this new research by the Geological Survey lays out the damage that could happen because of shaking, because of fire, potential landslides, people needing to be rescued, collapsed buildings. Out of those, what do you think is the biggest risk to life?
I think the biggest risk to life is collapsing of buildings. And we have building codes, modern building codes, that will allow a building to stand and allow you to get out. Really, they're designed to save life. But we also have a lot of older structures. We have unreinforced masonry buildings. We have what are called soft first story, where you have a two or three or four story apartment with a big open space underneath. It could be a garage. And we saw in the Northridge earthquake in Southern California that these soft story buildings just did very poorly. Also in the Loma Prieta earthquake, these buildings did very poorly. And they're distributed throughout the region. So collapse of these soft first stories is really the major, or would be the major, cause of loss of life.
David, you contributed to this report and you helped to analyze the data. You study this stuff for a living. Were you surprised by the results, how devastating this quake could be?
Quite honestly, when I kind of sat down and read through sort of the final results, it's almost depressing. And part of the reason for doing this study is to not only put out these general results to the public, but it's really to develop collaborative efforts between different agencies and businesses. The report sort of has a subtitle, which is "We Can Outsmart Disaster." And the idea is to work ahead of time. We know we're going to have the earthquake on the fault, and there are things that can be done in every sector of the region to strengthen the infrastructure, develop communication plans, and do it ahead of time so that when we do have the earthquake, the effects are lessened.
And make a family plan and get an earthquake kit if you're out there.
All of the above, because this would have been a popular myth of, well, you've got to be on your own for 72 hours. But the estimates from this study are some parts of the Bay Area will be without water for 3 months or possibly 6 months. And it probably is going to be worse than what people anticipate.
David Schwartz is an earthquake geologist emeritus of the U.S. Geological Survey. He contributed to a new report and simulation on an earthquake potential on the Hayward Fault. David, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Facebook says it's introducing new privacy controls. They'll give users worldwide a chance to opt out of some features that could expose their personal data. It's modeling the controls on the European Union's new General Data Protection Regulation that goes into effect next month. Facebook is also planning changes that would let it skirt those legal obligations by putting information about most of its users outside the purview of the EU regulations. That's according to a report in Reuters. Facebook's data tracking practices have been under fire for weeks now. In fact, many companies you may not have ever heard of do plenty of data tracking. They know how many baths you have in your home, whether you're a working-class mom, the type of car you drive, and a lot more. They're called data brokers. Dipayan Ghosh is a privacy policy fellow at the New America Foundation and at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He formerly served as an advisor at Facebook and in the Obama White House. Dipayan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa.
So start off with the basics. What is a data broker?
Well, data brokers are essentially for-profit companies that are organizations that try to gather data about every aspect of our lives and just sell it off or otherwise try to commercialize it so that third parties like advertisers can divide us up like barn animals and target us with political ads or get us addicted to online content or figure out how to sell us a new car.
Okay. So they look for information about lots of things. We mentioned the number of bathrooms we might have in our home. They have categories like thrifty elders and bikers, Hell's Angels types, and even a category for novelty Elvis products, people who worship Elvis for good reason, I should say. Now, if you're an Elvis novelty product collector, what would they do?
Well, they're knowing that you are that kind of a person who likes that particular product, might send certain signals. Maybe you like those kinds of products and would go back to the store to buy them. Maybe you have certain political preferences. Maybe you have certain kinds of friends and like certain kinds of music. All of those things are inferences about your interests and your behaviors, which can readily be marketed to advertisers and other third parties that are trying to get you.
And this is totally legal, correct?
Absolutely. There's no regulatory framework, really, that polices this whole data ecosystem.
So I think a lot of us know that what we put out there is open and that we're vulnerable. But maybe people don't know that there are specific companies, these big data brokers in the United States. They are Axiom, Oracle, Epsilon, Experian, and some others. How lucrative a business is this?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how lucrative a business this is because essentially there is very little transparency into how these companies operate. But what we do know is that these data brokers partner with all sorts of companies across the digital ecosystem that have an interest in collecting data and commercializing it. And Facebook and Twitter and Google are some of those companies. Now, Facebook shut this off because of the public pressure that they're under at this time. And that is having a tremendous impact on the four companies you mentioned in particular. Axiom told the public that when Facebook took this commercial decision, Axiom immediately saw a very heavy hit to its practice, to the tune of about $25 million a year.
Let's hear how that shutting off came about, because the data brokers as a group came up several times last week during the days of congressional testimony with CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO. Democratic Congressman Tony Cardenas of California asked about how Facebook interacts with these data brokers to collect non-Facebook information on its users. Here's Zuckerberg.
Congressman, we just recently announced that we were stopping working with data brokers as part of the ad system.
But you did do that to build your company in the past.
It's an industry standard ad practice, and recently, upon examining all of our systems, we decided that's not a thing that we want to be a part of, even if everyone else is doing.
But you did engage in that as well, not just everybody else, but Facebook yourselves, you did engage in that.
Yes, until we announced that we're shutting it down, yes.
When you were at Facebook, were you aware of this practice yourself?
Absolutely. As Mark said, it is an industry standard practice. And what he's talking about here specifically is a feature at Facebook, which is still in existence, called partner categories. It is being shut down in the coming months. But this practice is the one that allows data brokers to pipe their data into Facebook's ad targeting platform and allow third-party advertisers like Nike or Reebok or a political campaign to use that data, which might say that, you know, hey, this person was recently in the market for shoes or cars or name the product.
So if I'm the individual consumer who's looking at a pair of shoes and a data broker finds out about it, should I care?
I think you should absolutely care, because privacy is all about giving consumers better choices into how their data is collected and used, and giving transparency into corporate practices. And that's what we're lacking in the United States, fundamental privacy rights. We absolutely need more transparency into this whole data broker ecosystem. And one important piece of that is legislation. In fact, Congress introduced a bill to try to get at these issues, and it's called the Data Broker Transparency Act. And senators Richard Blumenthal and Ed Markey and Sheldon Whitehouse and Al Franken, they have all been behind this. Most recently, it was introduced in late 2017. And it is a big effort to try to bring about better consumer choice, access to information, rights to rectification of data. But clearly, we need more bipartisan action and support, which is why Facebook's step is so important.
So do you expect that the other companies will follow suit with Facebook or not?
I think it's all about the public sentiment. It is all about whether and how the public and advocates can shine a light on how this broader industry works, so that the public can understand that there is really no privacy in this set of practices. And without that public pressure on a corporate entity, it's very hard to get a CEO to change course.
Dipayan Ghosh is a fellow at the New America Foundation and at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
It's been a cold spring in much of the country, with ice storms and whiteout conditions in the upper Midwest over the weekend and snow still blanketing parts of the East. If there's a tiny silver lining to all the terrible weather, it's great spring skiing. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann is a diehard skier, and he sent us this audio postcard from New York's Adirondack Mountains.
I meet Phil Brown at the trailhead on a frosty morning. He's excited by the scale of what we're doing, grinning like a little kid.
We're going up Mount Marcy, biggest mountain in New York State. It's about 7.5 miles to the summit.
We set off. The climb is more than 3,000 vertical feet through some of the deepest, snowiest wilderness in the East. Brown is a veteran backcountry skier and outdoor writer. He tries to make this trip every year around his birthday. He just turned 64.
What's it like continuing to ski mountains well into your 60s?
It's a little harder than it used to be. It's worth it.
Is it? Do you still get joy here?
Yes. You know, it's still an adventure.
We trudge up winding trails, leaving the valleys behind. The day is mostly painted in gray and white. Through cracks in the clouds, we catch quick glimpses of distant, snow-capped summits.
You can see, Wright Peak just came out. You can just see it peeking out from the clouds. Looks pretty dramatic.
It's been a harsh spring, and as we climb, the weather turns against us.
We're now up in the clouds. There's really no sky. The mist is in the trees, a little bit otherworldly.
We're right about at tree line. Can't see very much.
It doesn't feel like spring at all. As we struggle up onto exposed snow and ice and rock, the wind scours us, nearly knocks us over. We're climbing into whiteout conditions. Brown is a ghostly figure ahead of me. After a final push, we hunker down behind a rock 5,300 feet above sea level.
We're on the summit of Marcy. We made it. Had a fierce wind to contend with on the way up. Yeah, the weather is not too cooperative. We could barely see a thing. So skiing down the bowl is going to be an interesting adventure.
We plummet down the steep, wild cone of the summit. I'll be honest, it's scarier than I expected, like skiing through a dream where up and down and sideways all kind of swirl together. Imagine navigating a steep face of snow when you can't even see the tips of your skis. When we finally reach the shelter of the trees, Brown pauses to catch his breath. He's still grinning.
Skiing down that bowl was an experience I never had before, but you couldn't even see a train under your feet. You know, you hit a bump or something, and it was like a total surprise. And, you know, hard to keep your balance. And
what is the pleasure of this?
I think the pleasure is being on top of Mount Marcy. You know you've got 7.5 miles below you of skiing in a wilderness setting.
For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann in New York's Adirondack Mountain.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hockey in Vegas, baby. The Las Vegas Golden Knights made history this week. They became the first franchise in National Hockey League history to sweep a playoff series in their first season of existence. They beat the LA Kings 1-0 to win the best of seven series 4-0. They're set to take on the San Jose Sharks in round 2 of the series. At this time last year, the Golden Knights didn't have a single player on their roster, and their head coach was in his first week on the job. Now they're in the second round of the playoffs, and some Vegas odds makers now have them as co-favorites to win the Stanley Cup. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst, and he hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. He joins us now. And Mike, an expansion team, a favorite to win the Cup. How did this happen?
Yeah, you're right. A year ago, just a gleam in a billionaire's eyes. Well, I will tell you. How it happened is that the NHL created rules that were favorable to this expansion team. But, and a lot of people are focusing on that because maybe they were too favorable, just judging by the fact that they haven't exactly paid their dues, and here they are, possibly as co-favorites. Let's asterisk that, because Las Vegas odds are influenced by where the public puts their money, and in Las Vegas, the Knights have a lot of fans. But that said, so the rules were created where teams, existing teams, got to protect some players, and fewer players than has been the case in past NHL drafts. So the Knights had a lot of good players to pick, but how they executed that, it wasn't just the rules, because right after the expansion draft was done, no one was saying that the Knights were going to make the playoffs, let alone be so good in the playoffs and sweep the Kings. So George McPhee, the GM of the Knights, did a really great job, and the players have gelled. You know, give them credit too. I think it's been a remarkable success story.
I mean, it's not like they got a bunch of cast-offs. As you point out, they sort of used the rules to their advantage, picked up some great players, but many of them, you know, they seem to be overachieving and playing with a bit of a chip on their shoulder.
Yes, that is true, and also the chemistry between these players. Like, a lot of players, if they've been told, oh, you're the eighth best player on the team or the 12th best player of the team, perhaps they internalize it. Then they come to the Knights and it's like, hey, you're a frontline center. Maybe players are going to play like that. And also, beyond just picking and plucking good players from other teams, the GM, and I like calling him the GM because that's George McPhee's initials too, he orchestrated deals where he said to other teams, all right, we're not going to take this one guy who you don't want us to take, but in exchange, I want you to trade us some other player, or we'll take a bad contract off your hands. And in this way, it was able to construct this roster with players who believe in themselves and a system that's really working out. And I do have to say, though, if the NHL offered the deal to all of its teams, hey, would you like to start from scratch, reconstruct your roster, and we'll let you go by the same rules that the Knights went, I would say at least 10 of the teams would say yes.
Right.
And maybe, given their success, it's up to 15 or 20.
Right. Right now, my Philadelphia Flyers are getting humiliated by the Penguins. They might go for some expansion
and they
rules.
Made the playoffs.
Now.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, and a shout out to Knights goalie Marc-Andre Fleury. I mean, they picked him up. He was great with the Penguins, and now he's overachieving now with the Knights.
Yes, he was a goalie who was always seen as a weak link on a Pittsburgh Penguins team. But I do have to say, he's won Stanley Cups with the Penguins. He's playoff tested. And man, he's pitching shutouts with the Knights. So, yes, he's doing excellent.
All right, Mike Pesca. Thanks a lot, Mike. And go Flyers.
You're welcome. Yeah, good luck.
Last weekend's joint attack in Syria by French, British, and American forces seems likely to extend American troop involvement there. There are already some 2,000 U.S. forces in Syria. U.S. troops are also involved in combat counterterrorism or combat support missions in Iraq, Africa, the Philippines, and elsewhere. This year marks the American military's 17th year in Afghanistan. Phil Klei is a former U.S. Marine who's written about America's seemingly open-ended military missions, the Forever Wars, in the upcoming edition of The Atlantic. The piece is titled, Two Decades of War Have Eroded the Morale of America's Troops. And Phil Klei joins me now from New York. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you for having me.
In your piece, you quote a Marine friend who wrote in a letter home from Afghanistan, the biggest problem wasn't so much handling violence. It was, quote, a maddeningly ambiguous environment with an ill-defined mission set that kept changing. That kind of gets to the heart of your essay, doesn't it?
Yeah, I noticed, I mean, probably as early as 2011, guys in Afghanistan or coming back from Afghanistan who found it incredibly difficult to articulate either what they expected the mission to achieve where they had been or just frankly didn't really believe in the mission at all. You know, I quote a sergeant in a unit that suffered the highest casualty rate of any battalion in Afghanistan up to that point. And the sergeant was asked about, you know, the purpose of the war and what it was, and he just said, this war is stupid. So what? Our country's in it. And I just started wondering, what does that do over time? Mm. And also, why is it that we as a nation are just unable to provide even minimally coherent military policy such that, you know, the average guy on the ground could point to a public debate and say, here's the mission. This is how it's going to be achievable. This is what success looks like.
You ask essentially, is that profound sense of duty really enough? Is it adequate?
I think over the long term, it's not. Mm. And I think it's, you know, it is tremendously important to people that what they're doing is not for nothing. Nobody wants to risk their life for no purpose. And you know, people join the military for a whole host of reasons, but a sort of kernel of idealism is always in there. And certainly in terms of the things that bind people together in a military unit, a sense of purpose, a sense of mission is tremendously important. And that's increasingly difficult to find and at the same time, we're providing ill-defined missions, but we're relying increasingly on the same troops over and over again. So particularly in the special forces community or special operations community, we're sending guys on deployment after deployment after deployment. Head of Special Operations Command called it an unsustainable pace. We deployed special operations forces to 149 countries last year. And so it's just incredibly, incredibly wearying for these troops. You know, I spoke to – I remember meeting a Marine who had – not a Marine, sorry, a soldier who developed post-traumatic stress and broke down after his 10th deployment. You know, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask of anyone.
That's unsustainable. And you question whether America is really grappling with the suffering and the fallout caused by, as you put it, its mismanaged wars.
Right. So and I think one of the things that is really disturbing to me is the degree to which kind of public debate and accountability has fallen away. So I was in Iraq in 2007. I was there as part of the surge that President Bush had ordered, where we increased the number of troops to Iraq. And at the time, the surge was hotly debated. In September, Ambassador Ryan Crocker and General David Petraeus came before Congress. They were grilled. And so there was a real effort on sort of all sides of the debate to actually grapple with complex questions about what our military mission was, what it was supposed to achieve, and whether we were doing – whether we were achieving it. And then there was a little bit more of that when President Obama announced a surge to Afghanistan. But very quickly, particularly as he was trying to pull troops back, public discussion of wars became very muted.
President Trump as a candidate and now as commander-in-chief has repeatedly pledged to support servicemen and women. I mean, he's increased counterterrorism operations in Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia. Sure. But you write, an onslaught of counterterrorism raids doesn't make a policy. Do you think the lack of a clear strategy and mission is only worsened under President Trump?
Yes. And this is something that I was concerned about while he was running. I actually had a chance to ask him a question during the campaign. And the question that I asked him was, you know, I said, look, over the past decade and a half, a lot of Marines and soldiers have fought and died taking, you know, taking back territory from insurgent groups in Iraq and Afghanistan, only to then leave and watch new insurgent groups spring back. And my question for him was, after the fall of ISIS, you know, what was his plan for the region to ensure that that didn't happen? And he didn't really have a answer. He kind of gave a long, rambling critique of President Obama's strategy and then said that we should take the oil, which didn't make a lot of sense. And instead, what we've seen is in many ways a continuation of the policy that we've had under Obama, a little bit more bombast coming from the commander-in-chief and also sort of, you know, ramping up some types of counter-terror strikes, but nothing that would kind of cohere into a strategy. And the starkest example of the disconnect is if you look at what military leaders have been saying for years at this point, you have former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, talking about the essential role that the State Department and USAID and other foreign aid programs will play. And what do we have? We have a commander-in-chief who ramps up military strikes but is gutting the State Department, wants to gut foreign aid programs. And, you know, there's no there's no sense of forming any kind of coherent strategy for the region's that, you know, where we have battlefield successes for handling the aftermath.
Don't American citizens need to take more responsibility, though, for the disconnect between civilians and the military? I mean, people are out shopping and taking out the garbage and trying to get their mortgage paid while America is involved around the world, and there's this profound disconnect. How do you try to bridge that gap?
Yes, but I think it's hard when your elected leaders are are avoiding that debate. And I think that's probably where it needs to start because the actual problem is that we no longer have real accountability. And what I would like is I think every 2 years the president should have to go before Congress. He should have to explain where we have troops in harm's way. He should have to explain why they're there, what the mission is, what the benchmarks for success are so that in 2 years he can he'll have to, you know, justify what he said. And also what resources we would need in order to be successful. And then every member of Congress should have to vote on that and actually stand up for what they believe and provide some kind of oversight, which is, you know, constitutionally what Congress is supposed to be doing.
So a more coherent strategy would include clear authorization for war and sort of a more front and center public debate about the impact of the war. How would that improve troop morale? Would it affect the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in the field?
I think it would because if you forced public debate, you would then be forcing every member of Congress to actually take a stand, and we would then only have wars that the American people and their representatives had actually got behind. And you would also, I think, have a much better chance of providing clear, coherent missions, right? At the very least, you know, if Congress is going to be involved, if the president is going to be forced to regularly articulate what we're doing and why, that will provide clear public statements that service members can actually look to and use to understand the purpose of their own mission, what they're doing. And I actually felt that when I was in Iraq during the surge, because I could actually look at the debates in Congress and see what people were saying, measure them against my own experience of what was happening on the ground, and use that to come to a better understanding of my role and how what I was doing was an extension of the, you know, will of the American people.
Phil Clyde's a former U.S. Marine and the author of a piece in The Atlantic. Two decades of war have eroded the morale of America's troops. Phil, thanks for your service and for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
This month alone, climate change has been blamed for everything from killing coral reefs off the coast of Australia to slowing the current in the Atlantic Ocean to fueling wildfires in Oklahoma. In California, climate change is affecting the timetable for the migration and breeding of songbirds, and that can spell real trouble for some species. Craig Miller from member station KQED introduces us to a scientist who is measuring just how much trouble by listening.
Pacific slope flycatcher. Brown creeper.
I'm sitting here with Brett Furness.
Hermit warbler.
He's an ecologist for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
So that's a black-headed grosbeak.
But we're not out in the woods with binoculars. We're on his living room sofa near Berkeley. He's hunched over his laptop with his mop of graying hair and wire-rimmed glasses. And we're hearing recordings from a 15-year project by the Wildlife Investigations Lab where Furness works.
Very beautiful call. It's like a robin, but I think with a little bit more flourish.
This recording is from a forest in Northern California in May of 2016.
They're all kind of partitioning the time, singing not all on top of each other, but in different frequency ranges at different times. And it reminds me of an orchestra, but there's no conductor.
And the more birds, the fuller the orchestra, which reaches a kind of crescendo at the peak of the mating season. Over the years, Furness's team has made hundreds of these recordings, including more than 300 sites along the Pacific Crest Trail. And from those, they've been able to pinpoint the peak mating season and track how that's changing. And it is changing.
Their song is beautiful to listen to, but they're singing for a reason.
What Furness is most worried about is something called mismatch. To migratory birds, timing is everything.
They're singing to attract mates and to establish territories, and this is important for them to be able to breed and then maintain the population levels.
Okay, imagine you're on a road trip. You're tired and counting on a late meal at the motel diner up ahead. And when you get there, the motel is open, but the diner is closed. Well, that's what migrating birds encounter if their arrival and breeding dates are out of sync with their surroundings.
And over time, with climate change, we expect that to advance.
If the timing is too far off, it could threaten the populations of some species.
Indeed, other studies have shown that across the Northern Hemisphere, the breeding is advancing on average 4 days per decade, which is quite alarming.
Not far from his backyard up in the Berkeley Hills, Furness shows me the setup. The equipment is about as basic as it comes.
I'll show you right here.
He takes out one of those plastic tubs for keeping leftovers in the fridge.
So I'll get out a recording device here.
Inside is a tiny digital recorder about the size of a matchbox strapped to a piece of foam. I thought maybe they'd hang them from trees or something, but no, he leaves them right on the ground at the various listening sites.
Funny things happen to these. Bears have chewed them up and spit out all the batteries a few times. So they take a beating.
Yeah, and so do the researchers at times.
I actually got chased by a wild horse. And another one, I stepped on a hornet's nest. And I think another one, I almost stepped on a rattlesnake. So
these days he leaves most of the fieldwork to assistants. But the recordings that survive yield valuable data. Let's go back to that recording from May 2016, before the crowd showed up.
But you know, so there's a few other birds in the background, but it's really just this one bird. And so it has arrived earlier in the season. This is the May 20th.
Now let's fast forward about 3 weeks.
Later in the season, and there's a whole bunch of birds singing almost on top of each other.
From this, the team has been able to pinpoint peak breeding for several species to the day. And it's far less labor-intensive than catching birds in nets one at a time and banding them or dispatching platoons of birders into the woods to count beaks. Experts can listen to these recordings and analyze the audio to find when different species' songs are at their peak.
The baseline results suggest that migratory birds may be at more risk than other birds, and that's the reason why we're collecting this information, is to help us make the best conservation decisions.
Birds perform vital functions in the ecosystem, controlling insect populations, spreading seeds around, but they also make an irreplaceable soundtrack for our lives, if we pay attention to it.
The sounds, the soundscapes that you hear is just something really special that I think we have here in our California forests.
Even if you don't know what all the birds are, you hear them and it affects you. And so you don't have to be a scientist to appreciate why nature and the sounds of nature are really important for our quality of life.
Furness just hopes that same soundscape will be here for future generations. For Here and Now, I'm Craig Miller.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.